Welcome to this week's episode of the Deconstruction Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Spiker. I would like to acknowledge that I live and work on the unceded territory of the Sioux Nation here in the Okanagan. In this episode, we got to talk with me. My partner and fiance, John, interviewed me, and I thought this was fitting after taking a bit of break as I finished school to introduce myself to you guys and a bit about my research. It'll be 10 years this fall that I've been studying psychology with a focus on trauma, especially early childhood experiences and how that affects us into adulthood. A bit about the reasoning of the name deconstruction and what my plans are moving forward with my work and career as a psychotherapist. Trigger warning, we do talk about abuse. There's some hard topics we talk about, and I just would encourage you to be really mindful of your state as you listen. And if you find yourself becoming inflamed in any way listening to the content, just sit with that, honor it, let it be. Don't rush through it. Listen to what it's telling you. Be curious and mindful of what's being brought up and why, and that could be a jumping point into your own expansion. Of course, reach out to me if you have any questions or concerns or comments. And I just had so much fun doing this. It's something I love to talk about, and as you'll hear, it's something that I don't talk about a lot outside the academic circle, and so it was a really fun exercise to kind of synthesize all my material in a way that's accessible to a larger demographic. I want to throw in a disclaimer here because I'm very aware that when early childhood development, especially through the lens of attachment styles, gets brought up, that a lot of parents have this intense reaction, and that's okay. I would just encourage you to be really mindful of what's coming up for you. This is not a personal attack, and this is not even about parenting at all. It's meant to encourage that each of you are uniquely hardwired and developed to your surroundings, your circumstances, your experience, and your parenting, and so many more complex, nuanced factors and interactions. I did my entire thesis on the way that early childhood relational neglect shows up as insecure attachment style in adults, and that's such a narrow little facet of attachment style, and I still felt like I needed 40,000 more words to capture what I wanted to say around it. So this very broad general overview of the neurophysiological psychological development of people is just that. It's general, it's an overview. It's meant to stir up curiosity in you so you can maybe start to explore the narratives that you learned and the way that you were raised and the experiences you had and how they may be impacting you now. Positive or negative or neutral, we are all products of our experiences. So this is not anything to do with parenting. I mean, it's a byproduct, but this is not meant to be about parenting. And again, if you notice yourself having an intense reaction, allow it. What's it telling you? I mean, if we just strip away some of the layers that are guarding it, it's, I'm assuming, obviously guilt and regret of some kind, and you don't need to have that. I worked with parents in all socioeconomic statuses, so many different circumstances, and I can say with deep conviction that parents are doing the best they can with what they have. I do not see nefarious parenting very often. So I think every parent devotes their life to their kids in whatever capacity they have, and that's beautiful and that's holy, and I respect and admire that so much. Secondly, I know I talk a lot about my personal mental health journey and some of the traumas that I've experienced, my family's experienced, and I want you to know that I am so, so, so happy. I just live in this place of deep peace and contentment that I think 20-year-old me didn't know was possible, and I get overwhelmed with gratitude and thankfulness on the daily, and I wish I could go back and tell her that she's going to be okay, but she does turn out okay, because she's me, and so I don't want you to take away that I'm struggling in any way right now. I'm very happy, and it's been a journey, and it's been work, and it's been intentional work, and it's paid off. So yeah, I anticipate that this can maybe be a bit inflammatory of an episode, and I don't want it to be. I have zero intention to have people listen and be triggered and leaving feeling uncomfortable. So if you do find yourself having some sort of really intense reaction, then please reach out to me if that feels right, and I can hold space for whatever comes up for you, as long as it's respectful. And I think that I stand behind this message. It's what I live for. It's what I'm here to do and research and learn more about, continue to grow in, and to help undo a lot of traumas that people experienced. So I hope that this offers a little more clarity, and I ask for some grace, because I grammatically and verbally mess up quite a bit. I laughed so many times I was listening back recording it. Sometimes when I'm talking and I start to panic because I have social anxiety at times, I just say really inaccurate things grammatically, and that's a mistake. I hope you can figure out what I'm trying to say. And another disclaimer is, please do not attempt to do psychedelic assisted psychotherapy on yourself. It has to be with a trained and certified psychotherapist who's gone through all of the training. I'm on my way, but it's a very intense process, as it should be. And if some white man's telling you he's a shaman and can take you on a spiritual journey, he's not. I can say with a lot of authority, be very, very careful and picky on who you allow on those deeper, more expansive spiritual psychological journeys, and honor yourself in that. This ended up being a two-part series because it was too much content to fit into one. And that's it. So without further ado, here's me.
Do you mind if you and I just take some breaths together and kind of align and get in tune? And then it creates like a safe container for us to just be genuine and vulnerable together?
I would love that.
Okay, cool. Do you want me to lead it, or should we just breathe?
Do whatever you want.
Okay, let's just breathe in together. Breathe in. Our stomachs, feeling the air enter. And as we breathe out, just become settled. In your seat, in your room. Yeah, move your head. Get comfortable in your body. Breathe in again. And we'll do one more breath. And as we breathe out, let's exhale longer than we breathed in, because that alerts our nervous system that we're safe and settled. So just breathe in. Bringing our awareness back to each other as I'm looking at you and you hear me. We're in our spaces, but we're together. I'm excited to do this. I know last time we connected so deeply, it was just all that to say. I'm now going to talk about something I don't know if I've ever said out loud to somebody, but it's essentially me trying to synthesize 9 years of studying early childhood development and the way that that impacts adult, or how it shows up in adulthood.
I'm excited.
I am too. I love this topic so much. I'm just struggling with trying to be like, this is accurate and I can prove why. I'm just going to say it and not have to cite every single thing. And I could cite every single thing I'm going to say.
I know.
Okay. We know that the child's brain, which then affects the nervous system, begins to be impacted in the uterus. And so if the mom is facing chronic stress when she's pregnant, the baby will be born with higher levels of cortisol than normal babies. And cortisol is a stress hormone. So when we're stressed and when our nervous system needs to be activated to keep us alive, cortisone goes and it activates this thing in us. When a mother is under constant stress, that gets passed to her baby. So when these babies are born, they already are at a disadvantage than babies born in peaceful, calm environments. Day one, poverty, trauma, abuse, neglect, social standing affects how you're going to become as an adult, how you're going to develop from the moment you enter that delivery room. that's some heavy implications. Now we know that this child, this little brain organ, it grows and develops and adapts to its environment. So when you have a baby and it's surrounded with nurturing, attuned caregivers, the baby's brain responds to that. The baby's brain grows to its experiences. And therefore, when you have a baby born in really stressful circumstances or with maybe disengaged caregivers, the brain will grow to those circumstances because our brain's purpose is survival. And so whatever circumstances we're born into, that's how it's going to adapt. And so when a child with the attuned caregiver grows up, you can stop. There's certain neurons in our brains, the way that our brains developed, that release chemicals. And our chemicals are basically what control our lives, our emotions. So there's things like dopamine, there's serotonin, endorphins, the cortisol we were talking about earlier, which is the stress one, oxytocin, which is the love hormone. All these different things impact our behaviors because it's the way our brain is firing. So when a baby is born to an attuned caregiver, you can find increased levels of oxytocin depending on how much the mom has. You'll find that when the mom and baby share an eye glance together or attuned or whatever, it fires certain neurons in the brain. Neurons that fire together, wire together. So the more that this is stimulated, the more the baby will develop a healthy amount of, say, dopamine, say, serotonin, say, oxytocin. So when the baby is surrounded with nurtured, attuned care, the brain develops in a way that maintains a healthy level of chemicals that follows you into your life. When a baby is not surrounded with attunement, like say again, the eye gazing, cortisol goes up more, which makes the brain grow a certain way, and dopamine and oxytocin do not develop and therefore do not follow this person into adulthood. So again, we can see that before this baby is even like 1 year old, their brain is developed in a way that's going to impact them as an adult because they're going to have less dopamine receptors. They're going to have less serotonin receptors. Those are really, really important chemicals that dictate all of our behavior. A little story here. Ingeborg Matthes in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts book, he talks a lot about this concept. And he worked on downtown East Hastings in Vancouver for 10 years with the chronically homeless and individuals living with substance use, particularly heroin. And so he was interviewing this, first of all, he was there for 10 years, not a single one of those women living on the streets was not sexually abused. None of those men were not abused. And so already you can really understand that it's not a coincidence, it's not happen chance, and it's not chance or personal choice that lands you on the street in downtown East Hastings shooting up heroin. And he was interviewing this one lady one time asking her why she did it when she's going to die. And she's like, when I did heroin for the first time, it felt like a warm hug. And it was the first time in my life that I had ever received a hug like that. And what that was an intense release of oxytocin, the love hormone in her brain. And so the first time she felt attunement, connection, attachment, belonging, felt human. And so, yeah, of course, she's going to chase that when she lives in perpetual pain and suffering. And so when you can understand that these drugs are meeting a need that was not once met, their why to using them makes so much sense. And that's probably a core foundation of my counseling. It's what is the need that was not met that's now requiring you to get it in another way? And that other way is symptoms, it's numbing, it's addiction, it's emotions, it's reactivity. All of that alerts us to some sort of wound we have to go back and heal. And so from the get-go, when you're born, your environment, particularly the connection with your caregiver, shapes your brain. Not permanently because it can be healed, but chances are if you're raised in a abusive birth home, unless you're taken away, which doesn't safety, but not exactly better. You continue to grow up in this really chaotic, stressful environment. So your brain is already misfiring the wrong hormones, not getting enough of the right ones, growing according to how you survive in this environment. Now, if we go down to our nervous system responds to the activation of brain chemicals and the environment around us. And so if this child that in this stressful environment, or, you know, again, go back to the healthy child. This child is in a healthy environment, attuned parents, it's brain chemicals and neurons are firing in a healthy, appropriate way for development. And something happens, a big bang happens beside the baby's crib. Survival instinct, her nervous system reacts with either fight, flight, or freeze. And hers is going to be flight or fight. Nervous system activated, chemicals released. She starts screaming, crying. What she needs in that moment is attunement and comfort. She needs to be regulated. She needs to be calmed. Her nervous system needs to know that she is safe. So the parents come rushing in. They soothe her, calm her down. Good chemicals get released. Her nervous system gets regulated. She can now breathe. She can calm. And in that moment, she learned how to soothe herself because it was modeled. If she was left alone, her nervous system would have remained activated, which then creates chemicals, like kind of like in a feedback loop, the cortisol, a stress hormone, still being activated. Those are bad things to have on all the time. They need to be immediate reactions, calmed again, back to like neutral. And so when the parents come in, they soothe her. They're having that eye attunement. She's now regulated. That gets locked in her memory as an experience. Takes many more times, but eventually when that happens, she can sit, calm herself down, be released, be soothed, because that had happened to her so many times that she's learned how. In the stressful, chaotic environment, again, poverty is trauma, poverty is stress. And so say you live in a really attuned caregiving mom environment, but you live in a really bad neighborhood because that's all they can afford. And there's gunshots and there's backfiring and there's dogs barking, there's screaming, your neighbors are domestic abuse. Like, your the baby's nervous system, survival, loud noises, threat at risk, activated, needs to be soothed. Now say there is no caregiver there to soothe them. What happens is the brain stays activated, the nervous system stays activated, the baby stays elevated, and that's called chronic stress. Stress is an event that happens that activates your nervous system in a survival way. Again, freeze, flight, or fight, now fawn. And chronic stress is when you don't get regulated. And regulation of the nervous system is everything. That's the key to health. So now this child, its brain's already at a disadvantage because it already has higher stress hormones, which means it's going to react quicker and more intensely, does not have the normal chemicals that should come and kind of re-regulate the system anyway. So it's harder to even have it float in when they're soothed. And that's why adoption, whole other thing, you need some specialty caregivers to deal with. Anyway, you go to this child, it's activated. Nobody comes. So it doesn't have, they don't know how to soothe themselves. You can't just force your brain and nervous system as a child to suddenly release all these calming, soothing things. And so now it's just sitting there and it's crying and it's crying and it's crying. And in those moments, it's learning that something they did kept their caregiver from them, because their world is them and the caregiver that keeps them life. So not only is the brain and body being affected, now their sense of self-worth and narrative around themselves is being written in a way that keeps them small. I don't know if that's the right word, but so that's just, you know, one instance of a child being scared and being soothed. Now, if we bring abuse and neglect into this picture, where real narratives are being told to the child, such as abuse with children gets so complicated because this baby is hardwired to rely on its caregiver. And so when this caregiver hits this child or abuses this child in some way, to survive, this child needs to internalize it as they did something wrong because they rely on their caregiver for life. So it's really, really hard for children to hate their parents no matter what the abuse is. And that's hard for us adults looking inward to grasp. But if this child was to decide that their caregiver is actually evil and horrible and choose to hate it, that's cutting off their lifeline. And so, of course, this child has to internalize that I am bad, I am wrong, I did something that deserves this, which then just creates one fucked up narrative. And that's just abuse. And now neglect, it creates a whole different experiential developmental problem. And then if we bring back into this the emotional regulation piece, which is super important and key to everything, we learn emotional regulation through modeling. when you as a child, like this is just, you know, I always see like a spectrum of severity. So it's good away from the abuse, like obvious times where that child is going to manifest some of these symptoms later on in life. Love them. It's okay. It's not their fault. They can be healed. Let's just go to a child who is in a fine middle-class family or whatever. And they go and they're like, I'm scared. I'm anxious, you know, like actually expressing these emotions they're feeling. And the caregiver responds in a way that is invalidating and dismissive, such as, oh, that's silly. Like, you don't have anything to be sad about. Why are you like this? Like any sort of invalidating way, again, this child internalizes that narrative as it's not okay for me to feel this because that causes a disconnect and I need that connection with my caregiver to be alive. Does that make sense? It's a bit of a intense concept to grasp, I think, at first, maybe if you're hearing it for the first time. But attachment to your caregiver is life. We're hardwired for survival. Anything that threatens that attachment and connection has to be cut off from yourself because it keeps you from that, therefore threatens your survival. And when we cut off those parts of ourselves, that's called repressing. It usually, especially that young, just goes into your unconscious mind and then continues to dictate your life all into adulthood. But you don't know why, because you can't remember that one time when you're 4 years old and you went to your mom in fear and she told you not to be silly, and therefore you learned anxiety is invalidating and loses connection, so you can't feel that. So now it just manifests as this uncomfortable feeling inside of you, but you don't get why. We learn how to deal with our emotions from our caregivers, or that doesn't have to be parents, anyone, it's our caregivers who are around us, the adults. And when we aren't taught how to handle our emotions, we learn that they are not acceptable and we deny them. And then they manifest as anxiety, perfectionism, depression, extreme cases, mania. Don't even get me started on personality disorders, which I think is an offensive term in a way. When we go through those experiences and our brain is activated, our nervous system is activated, we come up with words expressing these emotions, and that story is told that it's wrong and bad. We shut it down. But unfortunately, that's not how our body and brains and selves process things. And so that shutting down actually means kind of being locked inside our body, inside our nervous system. And unless it can be fully experienced, brought up, processed, it will continue to just, again, unconsciously dictate everything about us. And that's when counseling comes in. Because everything I just talked about happens a million times a day at every stage of our life. And so, you know, I first started exploring early childhood experiences and how they manifest in adulthood, which is still right. But I've been filling in like, yeah, but when you're a kid and this happens, adolescence is so understudied. It's unbelievable. The intense emotions adolescence experience shapes, I think, this is my own thing. I can say that it's not cited. I mean, as in, I admit when I don't know something. Teenagers, in the way that they are so receptive to emotions, which kind of shape everything, and emotions are this physiological reaction response to what's going on in our brain and nervous system. When they experience emotions so intensely, that's going to shape and wire our brain and nervous systems in really profound ways so fast. And that's not even looked at in studying anymore. So that's fascinating to me, but I think all personality disorders develop in teenage years. TM Rachel. And so our brain is an experiential organ. Whatever we're encountering, experiencing is shaping our perception of reality and ourselves, creating these narratives that become core schemas of who we are, and everything derives from that. And unless we learn how to question those automatic thoughts, question the emotional reactivity we have to a situation, question why we view things a certain way we do, we'll be on autopilot. And I think not a lot of people in society are happy. Like, I look around and I'm like, you need to go to counseling. We know this. We live in the most addicted, the most in debt, the most unhappy, the most dissatisfied. Okay, I say the most, but honestly, like I don't think the Great Depression was happy. We're just, society doesn't know how to deal with its emotions, and we don't tune to what we need internally. And therefore we stay small and unhappy and accept it as status quo because we're told that's the way it is. You know, that's a societal narrative that is like, you suck it up, you push it down. And now we live in a society that not only creates avenues for disconnection, but also celebrates it. Like, we live in such an individualistic, competitive society that is us over them, survival of the fittest, when we're neurologically, physiologically, psychologically, spiritually hardwired internally for connection. And it's through that connection that everything inside of us heals. So when that connection, or I call it attachment in my line of work, is not available, is not offered, is offered poorly, you like, I want to say you develop symptoms, but they're not developed. They are, I guess, developed. But the thing is, when you experience attachment in a disorderly way, you grow to survive that endeavor. And usually that means by creating a lot of defense mechanisms, which then kind of evolve to numbing and coping mechanisms, because there's this internal uncomfortability, this internal
maladaptive behaviors.
No, yeah, that's the coping and numbing, but I'm saying maladaptive behaviors for sure, because you're unhappy. And it's like these maladaptive behaviors were once survival mechanisms that helped you get through the situation you're in that you shouldn't have had to be in, especially as kids or teenagers, anyone. Now as adults, they're no longer serving you, even if they kept you alive then, and now they're maladaptive behaviors. That's usually by the time it gets there, people come to counseling. But if we started the process so much earlier, then we could stop that. And that would just happen by teaching emotional intelligence, really. That's some early intervention. I think that society is created in a way that fuels mental health problems. There's not a lot of opportunities for authentic connection and healing. And with the perpetuation of just patriarchy, for example, emotional expression hasn't been allowed. And it's only through the processing of deep emotional pain that you can learn to rewrite your narrative and re-regulate your nervous system and brain. It's bringing us back to the brain and nervous system that's dysregulated, explosive emotions, by being able to sit with the emotions, which when we have maladaptive behaviors, such as numbing and coping, it's because we're avoiding the emotions. So again, everything comes back to what you're feeling and experiencing internally, which is physiological. Learning how to sit with it, process it, hear it, listen to it. Can you get out on the other side in a way that then models how to do that? So if we go back to that healthy baby in the crib who was scared by the bang and had that physiological, psychological reaction of crying outbursts, parents came, comforted, soothed her. She was regulated. Do that enough times, she learns how to do that. And so when we're instead of watching 8 hours of Netflix, or instead of buying the $1,000 Lulu pants because we'll feel happy for a second, you know, that immediate gratification hit of dopamine accessing the reward centers in our brain, sitting with like, why am I feeling so angsty right now? Like, what is this restlessness? Okay, wow, when I'm sitting with that, it feels actually a little bit more like anxiety. And then, you know, you'll start to feel it even more. Your heart will pound, your breathing will get shallow, your hands will sweat, and you'll be like, okay, what's this anxiety telling me? Oh, it's telling me that that interaction I had at the grocery store brought up a lot of old wounds when they yelled at me for saying I should have a mask on or something. You know, every single time, every person, every story, it'll be different, but listening to it, you will get to the bottom of it. Most people don't know how. That to me is what counseling's for. It's to experientially, which sucks, experientially process through what you previously had not allowed yourself to process. And there's no shame in that not allowing. It's the fact that from my theoretical orientation, accelerated experiential dynamic psychotherapy, we believe that symptoms arise by going through overwhelming experiences that you couldn't process through alone. And so the role of the counselor is now to come and undo that aloneness of being overwhelmed and guide them through it. And it's in that witnessing and the safety with the counselor, the confidence and knowing that they're going to get you through this overwhelming experience you haven't been able to get through yet, that you can experience it, allow yourself to process it, it gets integrated, and that wound becomes healed. May take many times, but that is the severity of the wound. So I could break so many of those different chunks into hour-long lectures themselves. I tried to sum up a whole adult's neurological, physiological, psychological development in a few minutes. So, okay, is there anything that I said that maybe you want more clarification on or want me to maybe expand on?
I wanted to ask, so I just wrote it down. So when you're saying the role of the counselor is to help recognize, my question is, they have that anxiety. They have something inside them. Mm-hmm. An uncomfortable feeling is how you classified it. That mm-hmm. uncomfortable feeling. How do you, my disconnect would be like, hey, I feel like sitting watching TV all day. Mm-hmm. That's how I numb, right? Or some people, I'm going to eat this, everything in the house, or mm-hmm. I'm going to do drugs or do whatever, mm-hmm. whatever it is. But how do you identify what, like, is it only through counseling that you can identify what that feeling, is it anxiety? Is it depression? Is it, I'm struggling with trying to understand how to recognize or how to pinpoint the uncomfortable feeling. That's what I'm.
Yeah.
Could you expand on that?
That's a really, really good question. And it's funny because to that answer, I would be like, yeah, go to counseling. Like, you clearly need an objective person speaking into your experience and being able to point out the blind spots you can't. And with your history, hopefully allow, like, offer more clarity. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't do AEDP alone. I do it with psychodynamic theory because I'm like, I need to know your experience. I need to know why you are shaped the way you are. I need to know the wounding and the patterns and the defense mechanisms, because through that history, you make sense to me. Like your symptoms, okay. Your everything. I'm like, this is why you're feeling this. Of course you're feeling that. Do you understand how normal that is? But we're going to honor that for a moment and sit with it. So that would be my answer to that. But also, like, you don't need to. It just takes intentional presence of your internal state. And like, I've been to counseling 7 times. 4 of them referred me out because they were incompetent to handle my level of trauma. So much respect. That's following SEPA's code of ethics, would refer them. 2 tried, super damaging, should not have tried to handle my case. And then 1 was a psychologist. So extensive, more extensive training, years more training. He was really helpful, then ran out of coverage.
Exactly. But, I remember. Yeah. Yeah.
So I really have not had help. I had to do this myself. And yeah, I actually have the degree and followed it and was able to like parallel my journey with everything I'm learning in a really integrative, helpful, holistic way. I'm sure I can hear the critics being like, well, you have a bias towards this, blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. But this is my lived reality and it helps people and it helps me. So it doesn't have to be for everybody, but it is impactful for the population that this speaks to, you'll know, because it'll feel aligned. So I had like, queen and numbing out here, no judgment. I have to be like, okay, I see you wanting to do this thing. Can we stop for a second and just, what are you feeling? What's going on inside of you? Okay, I feel a lump in my stomach. That kind of feels gross. I see we've been trying to avoid that. What's that? Sit with it like, oh, okay, I feel maybe shame. I feel, or let, I'll just do one that's really pertinent right now. I'm feeling really vulnerable. You know, I had a somewhat heated conversation about something that I'm really passionate about and they didn't see the same side and it was heated and we clashed and now I'm feeling like shame. I'm feeling anger. I'm feeling pride. I'm feeling vulnerability is really, and I'm feeling very raw and exposed and I hate feeling that way. And I'm going to do whatever I can to get out of feeling exposed or raw. So then I have to sit with it. And then I don't get to go run. I'm like, of course you feel really scared when you're feeling vulnerable and raw and exposed. You've done a lot to guard yourself and it's going to feel pretty intense when you let those guards down for a moment. And then I won't psychoanalyze myself here, but I do deeply in real life, in my journal, and go down to like, you know, I find the wound and I find the origin and I find the reason that I'm feeling that. That's really intense. I don't think a lot of people need to do that. I think all you need to do is just be like, I'm feeling anxious because I have a test due in an hour. Of course I feel anxious. Oh my goodness. Can we just allow that energetic bubbling inside of us a moment to show itself and be felt? Deep breaths. You have to do the test. You get through it every time. You're going to be okay. And if you're not, it's okay as well. It's not the end of the world. And then sort of just like pep talking yourself through, but you have to validate it first. You like, this is a, okay, maybe it's rabbit trail, but I feel really important about this. I am very against spiritual bypassing.
I don't know what that means.
Okay. So it's like trying to, it's or positivity bypassing. So it's like, rather than experiencing the hard thing you're going through, it's just like, oh, well, Jesus loves you. Let's pray this through. Like you get through this. Like it's always, you're stronger for going through it. Like just throwing positive bullshit on top of the pain and hoping that it'll pep talk them out of whatever they're experiencing. Serious problem in religious culture for sure. But it's also in the pop mental health culture as well. I would just call it like spirit or positivity bypassing. Like just think positive thoughts. Like if you just shift your perspective to more positive one.
You think that leads to more like you're repressing. Until you, yeah.
It's repressing if they follow you, but it's invalidating and damaging to the person experiencing it. And so it's just not helpful. I think it's very rude. And if the person does unfortunately take your advice, they will be repressing it, which is just going to cause more damage. And so it's through the processing and allowing you to experience what you're experiencing with gentle, gentle, gentle curiosity that you can then move into the place of helping yourself get through it. So you have to go into the dark trenches of whatever this wound is before you can just cover it. Like the way I would describe it is like, say, you know, when you get road rash and there's a bunch of gravel on your wound, they have to take that metal brush thing and brush out all of the rocks. Then they can oint it up and bandage it. If you just go to the ER and they just like throw a bandage on top of that, you're just going to grow wounds over top of the rocks that never got removed. And so the part of this processing of whatever uncomfortable feeling you're feeling is excavating the rocks and stuff. Once that's done, then you can start to put an ointment, band-aid, attending to. But the reason that metaphor sort of falls short is because it's really demonizing the uncomfortable feeling. It's demonizing the rocks, where when you're experiencing this big monster like anxiety, panic attacks, depression, they're really demonized inside of us and in society. And that's where that gentle, gentle, gentle curiosity comes back and being like, what are you telling me? What is this? What's happening? And every time you're going to find a tiny little wounded part of yourself that actually just needs love, that needs nurture, that needs soothing, that needs comfort, that needs to be witnessed, that needs validation. Every symptom is a hurt part of you that needs tending to, not aggressive warrior pillaging or holier than thou bypassing. It is a process. And that process is alchemy. It is the diving into, the figuring out what's happening, the dissolving of whatever those thought patterns are that are keeping you stuck in this, like me, my vulnerability one, where it feels too raw to be seen or exposed in some way when I'm really used to being guarded. It's a diving into that narrative, that wound that causes that, sitting with it, processing it, allowing it to be, and then moving past, rewriting, restructuring, recreating it in something so much stronger, so much more beautiful and tender. And that's growth. It's through that alchemizing process of your, like when you alchemize pain, it becomes stronger every time.
You become stronger every time.
And so I do that on myself, and that's how I counsel. I don't think you need a counselor to do it, but I think I can do it on myself because I have a lot of knowledge in this. And if you don't know that process, like honestly, if you have panic attacks, don't do this with yourself. You can't. I have a history of panic attacks. Super valid. No shame there. I know exactly why they're there, and I know exactly when they're happening, and I know exactly how irrational they are. And you've seen me in it. And I don't need to be rationalized out of it. Can't do it. I can rationalize myself very clearly. I can, however, sit with the unbelievable uncomfort and terror in a way that soothes me through the experience because I have knowledge and practice. If you don't know how, if you don't even know why, if you don't know when they're coming on, if you're not aware and you just come up with a panic attack, it is not fair for you to think that you can just talk yourself and sit with it and process through it. Like, that's so unrealistic. And so you really do need the safe container of a professional who knows what's happening and how to guide you through that, because it's through the, again, undoing aloneness, the witnessing, and the competence that the counselor knows what they're doing, and you're going to be okay even if it feels like you're dying. To get back to your question, I think if you're really intuitive, aware, internally, introspective, I guess is the word I'm looking for. If you're an introspective person, I think you do have the ability to really recognize what's coming up and kind of explore it a little bit, but it's not intuitive for everybody because it's not something taught in society. It's not mainstream knowledge. Like, sometimes I forget, like, people don't even know what ACEs is, and that just like blows my mind. So I have to be careful of like,
what I don't know what ACEs is.
Yeah, you do. It's adverse childhood experiences. Like the ACEs study.
Know that.
Yeah.
Yes, okay,
yeah. I sometimes project all my knowledge onto like, you should know this. Like, why are you reacting this way? Do you not understand like trauma and history and the way it causes? And then they're like, no, not at all. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how do you live your life? It's, yeah, you can do it by yourself. I think it's a lot of hard work. I think it's hard to know where to find support and resources if you do take on this endeavor alone. If you do, contact me because I have so many, but also do yourself a favor and go to a therapist that knows what to do and supports and guides you through it. Did that answer your question and make it more confusing?
It added a lot to it. It added a lot to it. I was looking for a fix. I wasn't. I was just curious. It just stood out to me. Yeah, there's a lot of information, Rach, to digest. And I feel like I've heard parts of this, and that was a really good encapsulating, I guess, summary.
It feels like my capstone where I'm like, I'm only giving sentences to what needs chapters and paragraphs to what I need to write books or what books have been written on. And so I feel like it's so such a huge, broad topic.
I need myself, and I don't think I'm alone in this, whereas you have 8 years to research something and know that it's so much more in depth. I need the Coles Notes first. And then from there, I can choose where I'm going to research or break myself, my mind. I break it apart bit by bit by bit to digest it, to fully understand it. But first, I need the broad strokes. And that's what you are attempting to do.
Cool.
It does make sense. But for me, like, I asked a question at the very end because I should have been taking notes the whole time. I want a fix answer. So here I am. This has happened. I was neglected in the crib. I'm here in life. Da, 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 da. What can you do? And the answer is counseling. And you're just like, oh, okay. Counseling,
I
a lot of hard work.
Counseling helps.
No.
You can
no.
do it.
But what I'm saying is that it's just like, to me, that's just like, yeah, like it's, you live in a society, we all live in a society where I want the food pill. Mm-hmm. I want the easy fix pill. I want the diet pill. I want mm-hmm. this, that just, I take it and it's just fixed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm lucky the way I was raised, and, you know, we're not without our problems or different issues that we all have, but I am definitely on the happy end of the spectrum. So what I guess I could say is that a lot of time I was able to relate and try to think about myself, but put myself in the shoes of the healthy baby mm-hmm. with the healthy attachments. And then try to see myself from another person's perspective. And that's kind of where your talk was taking me. That's where my brain was. And mm-hmm. I don't know if that's great you want to listen to, but that's where I was.
No, when I talk about this, I want people to put it back on themselves and kind of yeah. recognize the way that maybe they were raised, not maybe, the way they were raised
the
will impact,
raised, yeah.
impact
yeah.
who they are now. And so will all the experiences that they've been through since then. But I mean, it's like a common thing in the psychiatric field to say that everything that happens in the first 24 months is hardwiring you for the rest of your life. First 5 years, 100%. I think that's, talking about fatalistic, I think that that is accurate, but not determinational. It's like, that will shape you, but that not permanently, unless you allow it to be. Unless you allow it to maintain the same way, you do have the ability to go back and rewire your brain. But yes, to your point, that takes work, hard work, intentional work, and consistent work. There is no way to rewire your systems in a fast way, except what we're finding is plant medicine seems to do that very effectively. And then if you have aftercare, after like 6-8 sessions of clinical care, after doing an intense psychedelic clinical psychotherapy session, that's pretty permanent change in a good way. Like permanent it is, and it has rewired you, but obviously you can rewire that as well.
I've heard that too, Ray. And what specifically, what speeds it up?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So the analogy that I heard and I continue to use is we are creatures of habit. The reason that I'm saying everything that I am is because when we have experiences, it creates a pathway in our brain. And the more we have that pathway, the more instilled it gets. And that's why habits are really hard to break, because habits are doing something consistently. So that's a well-grooved path in your brain. So the analogy is, imagine a snow globe with like a snow hill, and the sled is going down the hill. It goes down the hill. It goes down the hill. Like in the one route, it's a well-established path. It's, you know, the snow everywhere, and there's where that sled goes down over and over again is well established.
Tracks.
That's like your track. Yeah. Tracks, but consistent paths.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
So what psychedelics does is it comes and shakes up that snow globe and disrupts all of those neural pathways that are deeply ingrained inside of us through a flood of chemicals and a lowering of the ego and conscious unconscious boundary, so that suddenly we're more attuned to new experiences that are not inhibited by past behaviors or past beliefs or past thought patterns. And these new experiences can get instilled in this like really fertile space your brain is in a faster way. MDMA works sort of differently in a way that it does do that. Because, sorry, I'll just say that the clinical trials.
It's sort of
differently in a way. Well, the clinical trials for its efficacy working with PTSD is pretty freaking phenomenal. I love research. I'm a slut for good research. This is pretty good research. And it's showing the recidivism rate of like panic attacks and PTSD-like symptoms very low, and the ability to move on faster. What MDMA does is, while it's still having that kind of intense neurological reaction on your brain, there is something different that is happening. This might go a little more spiritual, but I don't know if we have the words to describe it yet. It's this inhibition of the barrier that keeps all your unconscious pains and memories and stuff blocked to avoid pain. You are in this elated state where you can experience all your biggest traumas in the world in a safe, loving, nurturing physiological state. And so we avoid pain, especially when it comes to PTSD and unprocessed or repressed unconscious stuff, because it's too uncomfortable. Again, getting back to the, we do everything to avoid feeling bad. And some memories are too much. They really, really, really are. Like, that's again why I'm like, don't do things alone if it's too much for you. It can be very, very damaging. Do it in counseling.
I heard from MDMA research, you know, like a podcast years ago, it was a war vet. It was a war vet who lost his whole platoon or something like that. It was like a roadside bomb. And he spiraled and spiraled and spiraled for years. Eventually he was able to go through this, these different trials. Nothing was helping. Then he had MDMA. And his outlook switched.
And so what happened in that outlook was he could hold space for his guilt of surviving. And he could hold space that his worth was allowed to be lived, even though he lost all of his best friends in that moment. And guilt and shame and regret was processed in those moments when it was too overwhelming before, and he couldn't face that. He couldn't get over the fact that he survived and they didn't, and how dare he have a good life. And so he destroyed his life. in that space, that's like the unblocking of that unconscious material in the state MDMA allows, it's like you are nurturing and caring and regulating yourself. You are your caretaker in that moment, and you can create this space that doesn't send you physiologically spiraling. So it's like, it will be really hard to understand externally and cognitively, I think, but anyone who's read the research, if you've done MDMA, you know that this creates an open, receptive space that's just pure healing and acceptance. And acceptance for your traumas are everything. Acceptance for your shadows, which is unconscious repressed material, is everything, because it's only in that acceptance we give them space to be seen and therefore felt, understood, processed, and moved past. But I'm not kidding when I say I understand some stuff's too hard to face. Like, I'm not out there being like, oh, you were raped all your childhood. Like, just process that now in safety. If you give it space and gentle curiosity, you can move past it. Not how we work. That won't work. You'll probably end up in the psych ward. Like, be gentle on your capacity and your space, and don't do it unsafely, because maybe if you're listening to this and you now feel like a new inspiration or vigor, that's awesome. But make sure you are so in tune and aware of your capacity and what you can handle, because I really think all symptoms that we see in counseling are due to the inability to experience overwhelming emotions alone. So maybe if this inspires you to face your stuff, go to counseling.
So if you didn't want to go to counseling, or you couldn't get into counseling because of wait times or wait lists or money, mm-hmm. or whatever barrier it is, are there different, well, let's call them like, yeah, self
meditate,
different daily mental health rituals.
Yeah. Oh my
goodness. Are there different ones that you would do, or that you would recommend, or that you do, mm-hmm. that help you on a daily basis? Like,
yeah, I think a lot of traumas and symptoms shouldn't be dealt with alone. And I think it's exactly in the witnessing and validating that is so important for the healing. But if you're just more on the worried well spectrum, you maybe have a sense of dissatisfaction or are uncomfortable with how much you numb out on TikTok, what I would recommend, if you are really interested in being aware of your responses and challenging them in a way that perpetuates growth, is an embodied way of living and relating with yourself. So if you are finding yourself unhappy, dissatisfied, reactive, general sense of unhappiness, you know, discontentment, then you need to, I'll just tell you this story because it sort of fits, okay? Mm-hmm. So today I had a realization around the process, long-term process that I had to go through to get healing. And so it's hard for me to be like, just do this practice, just do this practice, because it's like I found a stage by stage thing. So for example, you've kind of been with me on this whole religious deconstruction, undoing the spiritual abuse I experienced through Westside. And so what that looked like for me was recognizing the wounds that were caused and recognizing that those wounds are manifesting in all kinds of problematic behavior. And that recognition led to processing emotions I felt about that abuse. So that looked like anger. And anger is my default second step processing of everything that I go through, as you've witnessed. And so I had to feel that anger. That anger was holy and important and healing and necessary for me to move on. That's kind of like the excavating thing we're talking about, to move on to now recognizing the belief systems or the narratives that I had developed and had in place from that experience. And only through that recognition, processing of painful emotions, to recognizing the narratives that I now had in place that not only were a result of that, but continuing to perpetuate the negative, abusive, whatever. From that place of recognizing the narrative, I could then deconstruct the narrative, challenge it, relearn it.
Reprogram.
Remember, reconstruct, reprogram in a new healthy way. Mm-hmm. And then I come on the other end with healing and growth. Mm-hmm. That's alchemy. The mm-hmm. process of deconstruction is alchemy. And so that stage process from the recognition, processing, understanding the narrative to rewriting the narrative, each of those have different things that I would recommend for self-care rituals, depending on where you're at in your healing stage.
Okay.
That being said, my personal one that kept me alive essentially was journaling. Every step of the way, that was this cathartic ability to process whatever I was currently experiencing. But writing isn't for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say that as some sort of panacea. But if you like to write and you're kind of this cognitive intellectual processor, writing will probably be really good for you, especially if you're introverted as well. If you're more extroverted and you're more community oriented people, like, find somebody that you can talk to that's a safe space and container that you can process these things with in a safe attachment based way, like external process instead of writing process. If I were to summarize, I don't really like the word self-care because it's kind of been misused in this whole pop mental health culture. But really what self-care means is being aware of your current internal state and tending to that. So when you're getting overwhelmed, you do something that releases some of that overwhelmed. When you're feeling depleted, you do something that energizes you. So an example of that, yesterday after my big ordeal adventure on the mountain, you told me to make sure I sang on the way home because you knew that was a physiological way to process that anxiety that I just experienced that would be trapped in my body. And it's a physical processing of what I went through in a way that brings me so much joy, so much alignment, so much energizing, cathartic power. So proud moment. That was very good. And so when I was in this like elevated, intense emotional space, I needed to physically expel energy. Mm-hmm. And that was my self-care. It's all the same thing. It's all a way to regulate your nervous system. And when you haven't been taught how to regulate yourself, it's going to come out in intense behaviors. Like self-harming is self-regulating every time. The way that it's been demonized in society, especially at young women, it's so damaging and continually perpetuating more trauma on top of whatever trauma they're experiencing. Self-harm is self-regulating and they're keeping themselves alive until they can get supports and resources to help them regulate that in other ways. So in other ways, me, that's singing, you know, that's hiking in nature. It's grounding, it's calming, it's physically moving out whatever I'm experiencing. Writing is the mental, emotional form of that. It's physically getting out all of this intense energy inside of me that's often too complex to really understand when it's inside my head or inside my body, mm-hmm. writing it out. Mm-hmm. So as you can tell, I'm talking a lot about our bodies experiencing these physiological responses to whatever situation we went through. Mm-hmm. And that's where embodiment comes in. Embodiment is being aware of what's going on inside of you. Half my life, no. All of my life up until 2 years ago, I lived in my head. I thrived in this cognitive supremacist world that got ahead from intellectual ideas and thoughts and talking. Very masculine, very disconnected. It's taken 2 years to really undo that bifurcation of self that we've been trained living in this society. And so embodiment is now consciously being aware and present in your body. So you can be aware of what it's telling you. Mm. And that's why, like in counseling, I'm like, what are you feeling? Anxiety? Yeah. Okay, where are you feeling that in your body? Where is anxiety showing up, letting you know? And it's all in your body. Our emotions are held in our body. And then we rationalize them through thoughts and symbols from words and language in our head. So embodiment means intentionally existing in the presence of your body and listening to what it's telling you.
So when you talk about a holistic approach to counseling, embodiment is a huge part in that, or it's apples to apples, right? Can you explain that then? Like when you say, I want to counsel from a holistic approach, embodiments, is it like a pillar of it? I'm not trying to send you on a tangent. I'm just...
No, that's a really, really good question. Let me just finish talking about embodiment, okay. And then I'll get into where that kind of fits in the holistic picture.
Okay.
As you're moving into this new kind of maybe expansive, stable space, and you start to move into your body and start to listen to what is saying, that's going to be a huge part of the puzzle for your mental health. And so kind of living in this conscious awareness of your body at all times is really, really beneficial. And that's where nonlinear came in for me. That nonlinear was sort of this ritual that taught me embodiment and is now pivotal in my ritualistic self-care practices, because so nonlinear movement method is this way of existing in your body and moving out the tensions and stress and emotions that you're experiencing. And so I call it like dancing yoga or unstructured dance. Yeah. And so becoming attuned to what is hurting or what is making itself known in your body and sitting with it, moving it, processing it, because thank you to forerunners like Dr. Levine, Stephen Porges, Bessel van der Kolk, we know trauma and emotions and pain get locked in our body. And so we need to be able to process that out in a real way that expels the energy rather than repressing and then show up as physical manifestations of illness. So mental health and embodiment go hand in hand.
Yes. And I want to say, like, from firsthand, getting to see you, when you decide to show me some of your nonlinear and mostly, sorry if it's banging, mostly witnessing firsthand the change in you afterwards, after that, before that and after, like being with you on this journey for the last 4 years has been incredible. It's been incredible.
There's been some growth.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's growth, maturity, learning, knowledge, and
processing.
And processing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just can speak firsthand that from after that nonlinear, like it set you on a trajectory, it seems. Mm-hmm.
And you know what that was? Allowing myself to connect with the feminine parts of myself. So I have been living in my masculine strength for 25 years. And let me tell you, I know exactly the origins of that. I know exactly why I did that. Everybody knows society views women as lesser, weak, feminine traits are, you know, valued less, exploited more, seen as weak. And so I was very intentional about being this powerful, driven, independent, cognitive individual that is unswayed by emotions or whatever.
Not afraid of confrontation.
Absolutely not. And then I realized I was living half of my strengths and maybe less than half my strengths, because the feminine is so fierce, passionate, powerful, intuitive, empathic, gentle, connected, leading, healing, nurturing, soothing, comfortable, intelligent, brilliant, inspirational. And so me suppressing those traits kept me small, felt big. It's a very big ego. And then tapping into embodiment, which is pure feminine energy, opened this box that I had kept repressed for so long because I thought that it was weak, and it showed up as my biggest strength. Mm-hmm. And allowing that energy, and I don't mean spiritual, I mean literal quantum physics energy that I had spent so much time holding down and all much like so much energy holding down, allowing it to
flourish.
Yeah, I was gonna say be birthed. And that was through nonlinear movement of accessing those trapped parts of my body, especially my womb, especially my hips, my sacral chakra, really sitting with the wounds and the tension there and moving and moving and intentionally connecting and feeling and becoming almost trance-like as I moved, released that. But that beginning journey was from embodiment and is from nonlinear, and it's expanded and grown and become deeper and so important. And I now can't like go back to who I was before I understood this. And so it's an integrated part of me, which means I'm changed in a cellular level. Did that explain what embodiment was?
Yes. And now I want you to tie it to the holistic approach to counseling. That's where we were kind of headed. You want to finish embodiment that leads into a holistic approach. I hear it and I understand parts of it, I suppose, or I think I understand. But I want to hear it from you. What does holistic treatment mean to you, or a holistic approach, excuse me?
Mm-hmm. I guess like my terminology would be a biopsychosocial spiritual approach to how I conceptualize my clients is holistic. And then embodiment and cognitive knowledge, history, and experientially incorporating all three of those would be my holistic treatment.
Okay.
So I view the client in a holistic way, and then I view my treatment method to tap into all those different parts holistically.
Okay.
So it's I almost see like a sphere, like there's all these multidimensional parts kind of working together.
Yeah.
And so embodiment is how I incorporate holistic therapeutic interventions. It's not exactly how I perceive the client, but I perceive the client holistically as well. It's just different terminology.
Okay.
That answer a little.
What is holistic treatment? Yeah, like that's the biopsychosocial, like spiritual. That's what holistic means. That's the sphere. Those are the spheres, kind of thing.
So biopsychosocial spiritual is holistically how I view the client.
But what does holistic mean? That's what I'm asking.
Holistic means seeing it from a multifaceted perspective that doesn't just focus on one area of cause or treatment or intervention.
Which makes complete sense because you need a multifaceted approach. We are not one-dimensional humans. Gotcha.
I mean, you and I can say this, but it's still quite controversial in the mental health realm.
Well, I can say whatever I want, but
I believe in the holistic approach. Yeah. Put under the wave.
Now I'm surfing the break. Thank you so much for listening to that episode. It was really fun and cathartic and interesting to have this platform to talk about my research in a freeing way. It's definitely done imperfectly. It was my first time, so I appreciate your patience with me, and I still hope you're able to gather some nuggets of wisdom. And I know I learned a lot listening to it again and recognizing where I can maybe refine or expand or stay focused more. I would like to thank Jonathan for investing so many hours this week interviewing me. It's very beautiful and connecting, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. Listener shout out to one of the most incredible women I know, Jen Walker. The depth and wisdom of this woman blows my mind continually. I'm so grateful for her and her input in my life and her support in this endeavor. I appreciate you. The song at the beginning of this is The Land of Pleasure by Sticky Fingers. The songs in the interlude are Another Episode by Sticky Fingers. And as always, stay curious, my friends. I'll see you next week.